From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Annette Bening is nominated for an Academy Award for her starring role in the movie Being Julia. She plays a celebrated British stage actress in 1938 who responds to the lull in her life by having an affair with a younger man. Bening also starred in the films American Beauty, The Grifters, and Bugsy. On today's Fresh Air, Annette Bening talks with us about her life and her career. She lives with her four children and her husband, Warren Beatty. Also, we remember singer John Raitt. He died over the weekend at the age of 88. Raitt was a Broadway star who originated leading roles in Carousel and The Pajama Game. He was the father of the singer Bonnie Raitt. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Annette Bening, is nominated for an Oscar for her starring role in Being Julia. It's her second nomination. The first was for her performance in American Beauty. Her other memorable roles include The President's Girlfriend in The American President and the femme fatale in Bugsy, the movie where she met her husband, Warren Beatty. In her new movie, Being Julia, Bening stars as a celebrated British stage actress in 1938. To her fans, her life appears full and quite elegant. But the truth is, her relationship with her husband, who is also her producer, has become platonic, and she's worried that she's grown too old for the kind of leading lady parts that made her famous. Things start looking up when she has an affair with a much younger man. The relationship even gives her an idea for her next play. Here she is with her friend Lord Charles at a museum viewing a portrait of herself. Lord Charles, played by Bruce Greenwood, is about to leave on a long trip. He figures she'll be busy reading scripts looking for new plays to perform.
As a matter of fact, there is a play that interests me. It's about an older woman who has an affair with a younger man.
Oh, a farce.
Why do you say that?
Well, because everyone laughs at the older woman.
No, not in this play. It's rather serious. The act one curtain's good. Comes as a shock to her.
What does?
That she's fallen in love with the boy. And it happens just when everything seemed to her so dull and unpromising, as if her life was over. She finds the affair exhilarating. And everyone keeps telling her she looks 10 years younger.
I trust she doesn't confess to the boy that she loves, and that's always fatal.
Does it sound like something for me?
Oh, don't be ridiculous, Julia. No, your public would never stand for it. If such a woman asked me, I know what advice I would give her.
What?
Break it off at once, it'll only end in tears.
But, Charles, she can't do that.
Why ever not?
Because she's fallen in love with him, that's why. She's helpless. The character in the play.
Annette Bening, welcome to Fresh Air. What are some of the interesting aspects of playing an actress so that we see you on stage and we see you off stage? So, sometimes you're in character for your character and sometimes you're just your character. How much more confusing can I make this?
I don't know if I have a good way of addressing that. I think the fun part and the part that when I looked at the script, I was just so excited by it, was that it does take place in the theater. It's kind of where I started as an actor. It's why I wanted to be an actor. And that combined with the fact that you see so many private moments, I think that's one thing that movies have over just about anything else in terms of trying to show us ourselves, is these kinds of private moments that a camera can sneak into. So not only is this woman, you know, this incredible diva, she's on the stage, she's acting her heart out, but also you just see her when she's kind of stripped down to nothing.
Some actors are always on. I mean, some people become performers because they see life as theater, and they're always on, and they always want to be on stage in the center of attention. But I think other performers are actually kind of shy, and when they're not on stage, they're just different. I mean, they're not necessarily larger than life when they're off stage. I think for your character in the movie, she sees life as theater. She is usually on even when she's off stage. What about you?
No, I don't see myself as someone who's always on. Maybe it's because I also have a life where I have so many responsibilities and things that I do that are outside of working and acting. But I agree with you about actors, and I find it very interesting that some actors are much more introverted and shy. I know I feel much more comfortable and always have when I'm working. If I'm working, acting, doing on a stage, or if I'm on a set and I'm working and I'm the center of attention, that to me feels normal and comfortable or appropriate, I guess is the word. In life, just being me, being the center of attention, sometimes I find very uncomfortable.
Can you explain that difference? Why you're uncomfortable having attention off stage?
Yeah, I don't know. It's funny because I can remember when I first started, I was doing only theater for a number of years, and I started getting interested in movies because I would see a good movie and I would think, oh, God, that's so powerful and someone has to be in them and maybe someday I could. But I had been working as an actress on the stage. I didn't have an agent. I didn't know how to go to interviews. And I remember coming to Los Angeles for the first time and I didn't even stay, but I sort of came and visited and met a few people and they would say, well, just go in and be yourself. And I would find that very intimidating. I felt like, well, if you give me a script, I know what to do. I know how to do that. That I'm comfortable doing. But just chatting with people, I didn't understand why that was important. I do understand why it's important now, especially in front of a camera, why it's important to just have a conversation with someone and see what they sound like, how they move, what are their rhythms, what is their kind of nature. But I didn't really even understand that then.
You made your first movie when you were 30, which is comparatively late for an actress who is really well known for her movie career. Why was it so comparatively late that you made your movie debut?
I wanted to be a classical actress. It's why I started. I really knew nothing about the theater or acting when I started. I just went to a play in San Diego where I was growing up. My English teacher took our class to a play at the Old Globe Theater, and I fell in love with the kind of marriage of ideas and emotion that seemed to be going on, and I loved watching the actors, and I liked the sweat on their faces and the sound of their voices, and it was Shakespeare, and the whole thing just kind of seemed very exciting. So I began to get interested in it, and I began to do plays when I was in junior high and high school, and that's how it sort of started. So coming around to movies, I didn't watch movies thinking about being a movie star or a movie actor. I just thought about being on the stage, and my heroes were people like Eva LaGallien and Eleanora Duse, and those were the people that I would read about. And then a lot of the English actresses, Judi Dench and Maggie Smith, and people that were on the stage in England who came from repertory. And so I went to San Francisco State. I got a theater degree, and then I went to a conservatory in San Francisco at a theater there called the American Conservatory Theater. Out of college, I went there, and in between, I was doing Shakespeare festivals. So that's sort of where I got my start. That's what I wanted to do, and it wasn't until later that I began seriously thinking about, well, maybe trying to go to L.A. or New York and trying to get an agent and trying to start doing movies.
So how did you engineer your transition into movies?
When I was in acting school, they had auditions which they would hold at the end of the year, and they would take the graduating class from what they called the professional theater training programs across the country, and they would do a showcase in New York. So there were four of us in my class from ACT. We were about to go into the company, so we'd had 2 years of training. We were about to go into our third year, which is basically when you get your equity card, your stage union card, and you get to be in the company. But at that point, we were all taken to New York, and we did like a 20-minute showcase along with all these other schools where they invite casting directors and agents and anybody else who wants to come and look at these, the graduating classes of all the acting schools. So I met a bunch of agents, and I met a gentleman named David Guss, who at the end of the day, and by that time I'd met so many people and I was so exhausted that I didn't sort of have the energy to pretend to do what I thought I was supposed to do when I met people. And I just sort of talked to him, and he said, I'd like to represent you. And I said, well, you know, I've now been asked to be a part of this company, this theater company in San Francisco, being asked to do great roles, and I want to do that. So someday I'd like to come to New York, but I don't know exactly when, but not now. And he said, well, keep in touch with me. So that's what I did. And I would call him like once a year. And I was then at ACT doing roles. And I would just check in with him. I did a couple more seasons there. And then I did a season at the Denver Center Theater Company, another regional theater. And then I called him up and I said, I'm ready to come to New York. And he said, okay. And he kept his word, and he signed me when I went to New York. So I just started going out on auditions.
Let's talk about one of your early films. And this is The Grifters, which you made in 1990. And this is a film. John Cusack is a small-time con man, and he's caught between his mother, who's a real scam artist, And then he meets you, and you're a con artist, too. So he's kind of, in a way, trapped between these two women, his mother and you. And I want to play a scene from the film. And this is, at this point, you're telling Cusack that you have a new scheme and you want him to be your partner in it.
Caroline, guess what? I had to tell you right away. I called a fellow I know in Tulsa, the one who plays my chauffeur. He says that there's a sucker there that's made for us. And a broker that just shut down. We can use their office, not change a thing. Now, I can scrape up 10 grand if I try. I got a couple of aces in the hole, some markers I could call on for something real. That leaves 15 or 20 for your end. We can start this weekend, get the sucker into position.
Hold it. Now, you're talking some pretty tall figures. What makes you think I got that kind of money?
Well, you must have. Now, you know you do, Roy.
Maybe I like it where I am.
Well, maybe I don't. I had 10 good years with Cole, and I want him back. I gotta have a partner. I looked and I looked, and believe me, brother, I kissed a lot of f***ing frogs. And you're my prince.
Do I get any say in this?
No, because...
That's what I say. What I say is no, we don't do partners.
That's a scene from The Grifters. Annette Bening, did you go back and watch a lot of film noir before performing in The Grifters?
I did watch some. Stephen Frears, who directed the picture, gave me some ideas. He also had me watch a lot of Gloria Graham, and she was a wonderful actress who did a number of those film noirs, and there was something particular about her that he liked, and then I began to kind of fall in love with. She's a very interesting person as well, her own personal life. But I also felt that in that particular character and that picture, the style of it was really influenced by the costume designer. His name was Richard Hornung. He's passed away, but he was a great designer. And I just, every once in a while, you go into a fitting for a film, especially, and you feel like the designer hands you the character. In a way, I think Hornung did that because he had such a specific eye and a specific idea for Angelica as well, and Angelica looked incredible in the picture. So those costumes, and also I completely changed the way I looked. I cut my hair, I dyed it, and I did all this stuff. So that helps.
You know, you said that the clothing really gave you a sense of the character. Of course, there's one scene in which you're wearing absolutely nothing, and this is a scene where your landlord wants the rent, you're really behind, and you kind of invite him into your apartment. He walks in, you're laying there naked in bed, waiting for him, and he says, I need the money, and you say, oh, it's over there, and you point to the far end of the room where the money is, and you basically offer him the choice of, you know, the rent money or you. And, you know, it's a very seductive scene, one of several seductive scenes in it, and it made me wonder, before you became an actress, were you familiar with that sense of using your body in such an overtly seductive way? It's something you see all the time in the movies, but I always wonder if the actresses who know how to do that in movies really have lived any of their life that way.
No, Terry, I have to say, I probably could say pretty safely no, I had never experienced anything like that. I thought that the comedic nature of the moments in which Myra, if I remember her name right, Myra in The Grifters, was naked, it seemed right. And because it was comedic, it seemed particularly appropriate. And so doing it actually was pretty liberating. That moment, though, when the guy actually ends up jumping on top of me, that was not my favorite moment. There's another scene where John's actually chasing me around. I'd forgotten about it. And then I saw it recently and thought, wow. Yeah, he sort of chases me around a room, throws me over his shoulder and everything. No, it was actually very liberating at the time. Yeah.
Liberating in what sense?
Taking your clothes off, running around. Mm-hmm, it was liberating.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, what's the big deal, you know?
Right.
My guest is Annette Bening. She's nominated for an Oscar for her starring role in Being Julia. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Annette Bening. She's nominated for an Oscar for her starring role in Being Julia. Let's talk about Bugsy. And this is the movie in which you met your husband, Warren Beatty. And he plays, you know, Ben Siegel, Bugsy Siegel, who builds up a lot of Vegas. And you play Virginia Hill, who, you know, becomes his lover. Now, this is a scene from when you first meet. And he's just met you. He's very interested in you. You've walked away. He's just found out from his friend that you are actually the girlfriend of Joey Adonis. And he, you know, Bugsy walks back in your direction and has this conversation with you.
Look, you're Ben Siegel and I'm Virginia Hill, okay?
Yeah.
Now, why are you so interested in a gal who's going with your friend?
What friend? Joey A. He's no friend of mine. He's an associate of an associate. Are you still going with him?
If it were New Year's Eve, he would be my date. Who would your date be?
Wife.
Wife?
Esther.
Esther?
Esther. E-S-T-A.
Good. Let me guess. I'll bet Esther lives her life faithful to her one and only Ben, who plays around like a jackrabbit on the side and lies about it through his teeth.
I don't lie to Esther.
That's noble. What do? Confess your sins three times a day? Now, what exactly does Mr. Esther want from Miss Virginia?
Right now, Mr. Esther is having a tremendous amount of difficulty imagining anything he doesn't want from Miss Virginia.
Are you ready for a divorce, Mr. Siegel?
Never.
Well, my oh my, you're pretty ferocious where Mom's concerned, aren't you?
Yeah.
The rest of the time, you're just another good-looking, sweet-talking, charm-oozing, happy fellow with nothing to offer but some dialogue. Dialogue's cheap in Hollywood, Ben. Why don't you run outside and jerk yourself a soda?
That's a scene from Bugsy. My guest is Annette Bening. When you auditioned for this movie, did you have any sense that by the time the movie was over that you would be soon to marry Warren Beatty? I mean, did you have a sense that this was going to be that kind of chemistry?
Actually, by the time I was meeting people at this point in the work, I didn't audition. So I went and met with Barry Levinson.
You're past that.
Yeah, exactly. At that point, I was just like meeting with people and I didn't have to read, although I would have, I'm sure, if they'd asked me. Anyway, so I just met with Barry Levinson first. I had a drink with him and then I met Warren for lunch. So then I guess it was after that that they asked me to do the picture. No, the answer is no, I wouldn't have guessed that.
Is it ever confusing when you're doing a role with someone and it's a role where the two characters fall in love? Is it ever confusing what emotions you're feeling like from the character and what emotions are real?
A friend of mine, I remember when I was working in the theater, called it scene spill.
it's scene spill? I like that.
Scene spill. I know. It's a great expression. Let's see. No, I don't think so. I think really down deep, no, I think you kind of know you're pretending or you know it's real life. And what's interesting, too, about chemistry on screen, I don't think there's any way of knowing when chemistry will work and when it won't work and what that is. It's a very intangible quality when you're watching something and you see two people and there is that magical thing happening between them on screen. Because I've done pictures that you know, wasn't necessarily going on between me and the other actor at all. Not that we weren't friendly, but it wasn't like there was any kind of romance going on, and it seems like it kind of sparkles and works, and then other times it doesn't. So it's a funny quality to try to capture.
Were you willing to admit to yourself that you actually felt something for him before the film was over? Because I could see how like real feelings could interfere with the making of a movie, because real feelings could also end. Real feelings could be combustible. And you don't, I mean, if you're serious about making a movie, you don't want that to intrude on the reality of the movie.
Yeah, what if it ends before the movie ends,
exactly.
Right?
Exactly. Well, no, exactly.
No, it's a problem. No. I began to know as we were making the picture that there was something going on between us, for sure. I mean, we were discreet about it, and we were, you know, kept quiet about it. But yeah, you know, we started to fall in love. So yeah, that was going on. But I think in general, people, you know, all of us are very careful about those relationships and having to, draw the line and draw a distinction between what is pretend and what isn't.
Annette Bening is nominated for an Oscar for her starring role in Being Julia. She'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Here's music by Elmer Bernstein from his score for The Grifters.
Major funding for Fresh Air comes from Barnes & Noble, featuring the AARP Crash Course in Estate Planning, available at Barnes & Noble stores and online at bn.com. Additional support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from the Alzheimer's Association, encouraging Americans to stay active, eat right, and make brain health a personal and national priority. At ALZ.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Annette Bening talks about her performance in American Beauty. Also, we listen back to an interview with John Raitt, the Broadway star and father of Bonnie Raitt, died Sunday at the age of 88. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Annette Bening. She's nominated for an Oscar for her starring role in Being Julia. It's her second nomination. Her first was for her performance in American Beauty, for which she also won a Golden Globe nomination and a Screen Actors Guild Award. let's talk about another movie that you made, American Beauty, and you were nominated for an Oscar for your role in this. And this movie is kind of part comedy, part drama. Your character is very unhappy, but I don't think she recognizes how unhappy she is. It's like she's protecting herself from her own unhappiness. And she's the kind of character who wants everything ordered, everything in place, everything cheerful, but there's no way she can fulfill that ambition in her marriage, in her home anymore. And this is a scene where you, your husband, played by Kevin Spacey, and your teenage daughter are at the dinner table. There's a real chill in the air.
Sorry, I'm late.
No, that's quite all right, dear. Your father and I were just discussing his day at work. Why don't you tell our daughter about it, honey?
Janie, today I quit my job. And then I told my boss to go himself, and then I blackmailed him for almost $60,000. Pass the asparagus.
Your father seems to think this kind of behavior is something to be proud of.
And your mother seems to prefer that I go through life like a f***ing prisoner while she keeps my in a mason jar under the sink.
How dare you speak to me that way in front of her? And I marvel that you can be so contemptuous of me on the same day that you lose your job.
Lose it? I didn't lose it. It's not like, whoops, where'd my job go? I quit. Someone passed the asparagus.
Oh, and I want to thank you for putting me under the added pressure of being the sole breadwinner now.
I already have a job.
No, don't give a second thought as to who's going to pay the mortgage. We'll just leave it all up to Carolyn. You mean you're going to take care of everything now, Carolyn? Yes, I don't mind. I really don't. You mean everything? You don't mind having the sole responsibility? Your husband feels he can just quit his job and you don't...
Will someone please pass me the
guys, I'm not going to be a part of this.
Shut up!
That's a scene from American Beauty. My guest is Annette Bening. What was it like to figure out how to play this character and how sympathetic to make her? You know, because we're seeing a lot of the movie through the eyes of Kevin Spacey because, you know, he narrates the movie. So you tend to see the movie through the eyes of the narrator, which would mean that when he's really annoyed with you, we're annoyed with you. So what was it like to figure out how sympathetic to play her?
That's really interesting. I guess it's one of the pleasures of acting is that once you take a character on, you are their advocate in a way. You are their defender, and that's your job. And I love that about the work, especially with someone like Carolyn Burnham, who's not completely sympathetic to the world. And a lot of people really disliked her and disliked the character, I know, because they'll say things to me. People will say, you know, that she was a villain or whatever. So I took a lot of pleasure in her because I did feel, as you mentioned before, that she was really fighting for her life. She was fighting for what she wanted. She wasn't always very good at it and didn't use effective ways of getting what she wanted, but she was trying. And I did fall in love with her, and I still feel that sympathy for her. That is, you know, that's that, and that love that you feel for your character, it does become that. It becomes, and so it does become hard to explain, because it has that nature of just being kind of deep in your gut, that you feel for them. You are fighting for their point of view. You're fighting for their side, and all good actors do that, and that's what makes good movies. If everybody's in there fighting and it's well written and the characters are all in there fighting for what they want and those things clash, then you've got interesting dramatic problems.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Annette Bening. She's nominated for an Oscar for her leading role in Being Julia. You are now the mother of four. So you have your hands full in private life. Your children age from, what, age 4 to 13 or something like that?
Mm-hmm. That's right.
So what balance do you think you want in your life between, you know, being a mother and having your career?
I think balance is really... it makes sense, but in a way, I think it's kind of overrated. Actually, creativity, I think, comes from excess. And that's probably the trickiest part of wanting to have a life with children where you have this responsibility and you want to be there for them and take care of them in the way that they need. But then you also want to find a way to keep track of what's going on inside of you creatively in your own separate creative evolution. And you need excess in a way for that. So... I feel lucky because I can do it and I can do both. I get to do movies and also have my life with my children. I don't think I'd be good at only working, going from project to project or play to movie or whatever. I think for me, it makes much more sense and works much better to have all of these responsibilities. So I feel lucky that I can do that. You know, having spent a lot of time when I was in a position where I was just trying to get work, to be in a position where I can choose to work or not work feels like a privilege. And with film, then when I do go, like I made a movie about a year ago and I'm about to start a film in March, then when I do go in to shoot a picture, I feel like I can really focus on it because it's been a year, again, since I was actually shooting every day. And that becomes an incredible experience for me and a real joy and a real challenge. And I don't feel like I'm doing the wrong thing because I'm not always doing it.
I really like what you said about people always talking about balance, but, you know, in some lines of work, it's not about moderation. It's really about throwing yourself into it.
Yeah, and that's important, and that's what's tricky, because as a mom, you do want to be balanced to a degree, right? You want to mm-hmm. be consistent, and you want to be there for your children in a way that they can feel safe and predictable, and that's important for children, and they deserve that, but that there's a dichotomy there between that and what you're trying to do, you know, in your creative life.
A couple like you and Warren Beatty are probably, you know, as close as it gets in America to royalty. Do you know what I mean? Because the level of celebrity is kind of on a par with what royalty might be in another country. And it seems to me that that must be a blessing and a curse at the same time.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think that's the perfect way of putting it. It is. The part where, you know, people say royalty, I mean, that's something that's like, it's a story that people kind of make up because it doesn't really have anything to do with us personally mm-hmm. or the way we live our lives or mm-hmm. any of that. So I guess that's the tricky part of becoming known on any degree, that you deal with people's ideas of you and projections that people have about you. I'm sure you deal with that on the radio, people, how people conceive of you versus how you really are, or how you see yourself. So I do think a certain amount of sorting through that helps when you can kind of say, okay, that's someone's idea of me versus who I really am.
Well, Annette Bening, I want to thank you very much for talking with us, and I wish you good luck at the Oscars.
Thanks for having me.
Annette Bening is nominated for an Oscar for her starring role in Being Julia. Coming up, we listen back to an interview with John Raitt, a star of Broadway musicals and the father of Bonnie Raitt. He died Sunday at the age of 88. This is Fresh Air.
It was 60 years ago that John Raitt launched his Broadway career, originating the role of Billy Bigelow in Carousel. In his signature song, Soliloquy, he sang about his hopes and fears for the child he's just learned he's going to have. Some people consider Raitt his era's quintessential musical leading man. He starred in the original Broadway production of Pajama Game and starred with Mary Martin in a TV production of Annie Get Your Gun. He toured the country in such musicals as Oklahoma, The Most Happy Fella, South Pacific, and Kismet. Raitt died on Sunday at the age of 88. I spoke with him in 1995. He had just released the CD Broadway Legend, his first album of new recordings in 25 years. It featured several duets with his daughter, the famous blues and pop singer Bonnie Raitt. We'll hear a couple of those duets a little later. Let's start with Surrey with the Fringe on Top from a 1964 studio cast recording of Oklahoma.
When I take you out tonight with me, honey, here's the way it's gonna be. You will sit behind a team of snow white horses in the slickest gig you ever see. Chicks and ducks and geese better scurry when I take you out in the Surrey. When I take you out in the Surrey with the fringe on top. Watch that fringe and see how it flutters when I drive them high-stepping strutters. Nosy pokes will peek through their shutters and their eyes will pop. The wheels are yellow, the upholstery's brown, the dashboard's genuine leather. With eyes and glass curtains you can roll right now in case there's a change in the weather. Two bright side lights are winking and blinking. Ain't no finer rig I'm a-thinking. You can keep your rig if you're thinking that I'd care to swap for that shiny little Surrey with a fringe on the top.
Would you say the fringe was made?
What's the longest run you did on Broadway?
Pajama Game, 1,060 performances.
How many years is that?
That's 2.5 years, and I missed about one performance. I would hope to say I could do, I'd done them all, but I didn't. I had one week on a Wednesday. I had such a bad cold that the doctor told me if I did both the shows that day, I'd be out the rest of the week. But if I didn't do the matinee, he could probably get me through the week.
Do you do exercises to keep your voice in shape?
No, because I'm a natural singer. I just have to go from right when I'm talking to you now. It's, oh, what a beautiful morning. It's right there, you know, so it's no problem.
So your singing range is the same as your speaking range, and you could go right into
it. Right, because I'm a high lyric baritone, which is the most flexible of all the voices for Broadway musicals. I have a long range. I have a big upper register, which helped me a lot with these big long songs. Like in the soliloquy, for instance, you start off down below and you finish up in an operatic aria, finish to speak. And not only do you have to have the stamina, but you have to have your knowledge about you, what you can do.
Have you lost any of your range?
A little bit, I think, on the top. I used to have it amazing. I could sing high C's, and baritones are not supposed to sing high C's, you know. But I think I possibly still could some, but I've noticed it a little bit up on the top.
Now, John Ray, you sang opera before going to Broadway.
Well, sort
yes?
of. I was luckily in California. We had a group called American Music Theater, and we were doing operas in English, and That gave me great training to do the Broadway shows, especially Carousel. And I think Rodgers and Hammerstein wrote the soliloquy because they had heard me sing the Figaro for the Barber Seville. And they knew that I had this operatic upper register especially, and it's certainly evident in the soliloquy. I call it a one-act opera anyway when I sing it.
Now, where did they hear you sing?
I came to audition. So being very cocky in those days, I thought I would dazzle them at the audition by singing the Figaro aria for the Barber Seville. And that did it. And that prompted the writing of this wonderful legacy that Rodgers and Hammerstein left for me.
Now, if I'm familiar with John Raitt lore, I think the way the story goes is that you were actually auditioning for Oklahoma.
I was. I was brought on to take over the lead of Alfred Drake. And they decided I might be a good bet for their new musical adaptation of Frank Molnar's Lilium, and shipped me off to Chicago, where I got my feet wet, so to speak, and played for about 10 months in that show before they brought me right in to do Carousel.
So you were doing the Road Company of Oklahoma mm-hmm. while Rodgers and Hammerstein were
right.
writing Carousel, and they wrote the soliloquy for you, also known as My Boy Bill. Why don't we hear it?
My boy Bill, I will see that he's named after me. I will. My boy Bill, he'll be tall and as tough as a tree. Will Bill, like a tree, he'll grow with his head held high and his feet planted firm on the ground. And you won't see nobody dare to try to boss him or toss him around. No pot-bellied, baggy-eyed bully will boss him around.
John Raitt from the original cast recording of Carousel. I believe you were singing the role of Billy Bigelow, you know, on the road or in summer stock, even into your 60s. Did it ever get to feel like, well, I'm really too old for this part?
Well, I think I was. I felt because I've had some arthritic problems, and I was having trouble with my left hip. And when I see the tape we did amateur tape, of course, I was a little bit set back by the fact that I wasn't as agile and as young looking as I had hoped feel that I am. You know, we feel inside that we're just the same. But then you look yourself in the mirror and you say, hey, buddy, you're getting along there, you know.
Now, you did the Broadway and film versions of Pajama Game.
Yeah, I was very fortunate because my big competitor all through the years, Howard Keel, had done Calamity Jane with Doris Day and very much in contention to do it. But George Abbott wanted as many of the original people as he could. And when Jack Warner was able to get a star of the magnitude of Doris Day, then he said, you can have all the rest of your people, you know.
Now, why don't I play Hey There, which I think is the loveliest song from Pajama Game.
Okay. Which one you want to play?
Which one would you like to hear? We have the original and we have the one that you
recorded
as duet.
I want you to do it with Bonnie. I think kind of fun to have the people hear
okay.
what daughter can do with one of Dad's songs.
Okay, so here we go. This is John Raitt and Bonnie Raitt singing Hey There from Pajama Game.
Hey there, you with the stars in your eyes. Love never made a fool of you. You used to be too wise. Hey there, you on that high flying cloud. Though she won't throw a crumb to you, you think someday she'll come to you. Better forget her.
Forget her.
Her with her nose in the air.
With her nose in the
she
air.
She has you dancing on a string.
A puppet on a string.
Break it and she won't care.
She won't care for
won't
me.
Like a brother,
or am I not seeing things too clear?
Are you too much in love to hear?
Is it all going in one ear? And out the other.
That's John Raitt and his daughter Bonnie Raitt, recorded in 1995. We'll hear more of our 1995 interview with the late John Raitt after a break. This is Fresh Air. We're remembering John Raitt. He originated starring roles in the musicals Carousel and Pajama Game. He died Sunday at the age of 88. Here's another duet that he recorded in 1995 with his daughter Bonnie Raitt. The song is Anything You Can Do from Annie Get Your Gun. He starred in a TV production of the musical. Yes, I can.
No, you can't.
Yes, I can.
No, you can't.
Yes, I can. Yes, I can.
Anything you can be, I can be greater. Sooner or later, I'm greater than you.
No,
you're not.
Yes, I am.
No, you're not.
Yes, I am.
No, you're not.
Yes, I am. Yes, I am. I can shoot a partridge with a single cartridge.
I can get a sparrow with a bow and arrow.
I can live on bread and cheese.
And only on that?
Yes.
So can a rat. Anything you can buy, I can buy cheaper. I can buy anything cheaper than you.
50 cents?
40 cents.
30 cents?
20 cents.
No, you can't.
Yes, I can. Yes, I can.
Anything you can say, I can
now,
say.
Since she's performed your material with you and you've sang a little bit of her material with her, what kind of advice have you given each other on how to do each other's songs?
Well, I basically said we are storytellers, and it's the best way you tell a story is whatever, if you need to speak the lines or sing the lines. And she didn't realize, I don't think, that she had such a good, legitimate soprano voice. And I knew it all the time. And she has blossomed so that it's just a tremendous gratification to me to be able to sing with her just as a singer. I mean, she sounds a lot like Mary Martin, as you can tell even in the song that we just played. And it's just been a great joy for me to be able to, I'm not conscious in some ways when we get going that the father and daughter bit. I just, is another great performer that I'm singing with.
Now, has she given you any advice about how to sound when you're performing with her on her songs?
Yeah, she told me a little bit on some of the things because it's a different style of singing, but it's good.
So what'd she tell you?
Well, just have to loosen up a little bit, you know, that have a little more feeling for the song.
Now, I think it was about, would you say, 14 years ago that you married the woman who had actually been your childhood sweetheart?
Yeah, Rosemary Kramer was her name, and she was Scotch. No, I was Scotch. She was a Spanish land-grant Catholic in the area in Orange County. In fact, her family goes back to 1769. She's eighth generation Californian and only child. And she had one of those mothers that had bigger aspirations for her son-in-law than a guy at that time was going to be an athletic instructor or a coach. So they separated. I was Scotch Presbyterian, so they separated on the religious grounds. And today, you, of course, wouldn't listen to it. You just take off.
So they refused to let you get married?
Yeah. 41 years later, we finally, after her second marriage, after my second marriage, fortunately, we were both free and available, and it was a marvelous experience, and we've been having a great time making up for it for 14 years.
Had you kept in touch over the years?
No. The only time I saw her, I came back as a local boy makes good after Carousel to do a concert in Fullerton, California, in Orange County. And in the reception line was Rosemary and her mother. And her mother was one of these beautiful ladies that with the long eyelashes and the blue eyeshadow. She took me aside at the reception and said, "We made a mistake. You were always our favorite."
Oh, yeah, sure. Too late for that.
That's right.
So
that's the only time I saw her in the 41 years.
You weren't going to be good enough. You weren't going to be good enough professionally. If you don't mind my asking, what did your wife's first husband do professionally?
He was an attorney. Her mother picked out her husband for her.
Uh-huh.
She was in such a state of shock, we find, you know, because we had a really serious love affair. She would always come see me sing when I did. I did 8 shows for the Civic Light Opera out in Los Angeles, and she probably saw them all, but she said it was such a traumatic experience for her, she doesn't remember it too well.
So she would come and see you sing, but not tell you she was in the audience?
No. No, I called up when I got a telephone number, and this lovely voice answers, and I said, "This is your first love. This is 41 years later, right?" And she says, "Who is this?" Thinking I'm a nut, of course. And I told her, and she says, "Well, you're right. You were my first love." And then went over to pick her up because I invited her immediately for dinner. I was always strong with Rosemary, not too with the other two wives. And she stuck her head out the door and says, "What do you see to me?" And I said the best ad-lib line I ever gave on or off stage by saying, "I see the same eyes I saw 41 years ago," which is pretty romantic, I guess.
So did you ever ask yourself if you think the marriage would have stayed together?
Well, yeah, we talked about it a lot. And Bonnie's awful happy that we didn't get married, of course.
That's right. She wouldn't have been born. I guess things work out for the best.
I know they work out, you know. We're still friendly with my two wives. My second wife is Kathy, still has the name, and she's the executive secretary for Jimmy Niederlander, the Niederlander Theaters. So whenever I need Broadway tickets, I call up Kathy and she gets tickets.
That sounds handy.
Yeah, why not?
John Raitt, recorded in 1995. He died Sunday at the age of 88. Here he is on the original cast recording of Carousel from 1945.
If I loved you, time and again I would try to say.
Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Patty Leswing, Ian Chillog, and Sam Brigger. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrell's at 1-877-213-7374. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, from the Ford Foundation, whose magazine reports on how arts education is being used to boost student achievement in Texas schools at fordfound.org. And from the Wallace Foundation, supporting ideas, sharing solutions, expanding opportunities, on the web at wallacefoundation.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, actor Seth Green. He co-created Robot Chicken, a new fast-paced, stop-motion animation variety show on Comedy Central. Green's been acting since the age of 8. His early roles were in Hotel New Hampshire and Radio Days. He became famous playing the son of Dr. Evil in the Austin Powers movies. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.